Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politech. Got a very interesting man on the line right now. His name is Andrew Puzner. Andrew is a graduate of Washington University Law School, where he was the senior editor of the Law Review. A very interesting guy, has some very interesting political ideas. We're going to talk about them perhaps later on during the course of this discussion. When he was practicing law in St. Louis, Andrew authored some legislation which the U.S. Supreme Court upheld in Webster versus Reproductive Services. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. When I got out of law school, I was looking for courtroom experience. You wanted to get courtroom experience, and it was tough. So I volunteered to defend people that were sitting in at the abortion clinic in St. Louis. They were it reminded me of the sit-ins from when I was in college. And ended up defending them and learned a lot about the issue when I was doing so, including the irrefutable evidence that human life begins at conception. There's really no scientific basis for claiming anything else. So when those cases started to, we won a lot of cases defending people on the basis that life begins at conception and using something called the justification defense, which said that the protesters were there to protect human life. And when I got to the end of those cases, there were some injunctions issued, and really the defense didn't work against an injunction. It occurred to me that we should pass a state law just stating that human life begins at conception and extending the rights of unborn children in areas such as tort law, which is personal injuries, and trust and estates law, and criminal law, so that if somebody killed, you know, if you shot a mother in the stomach and you killed her unborn child, that would be murder. You had taken the life without her consent. Mm-hmm. We put an exception in the bill for abortion because the Supreme Court declared you couldn't regulate abortion. And the law passed in Missouri, and it declared human life begins at conception and applied to the interpretation of all laws in the state of Missouri, and still does. It worked its way up to the Supreme Court, and much to the dismay of many people on the pro-abortion side of the debate, the Supreme Court upheld it, and they were actually one vote short in that case of reversing Roe versus Wade, which I think would have put a lot of issues behind us a long time ago. But in any event, we won the case, and that is the law in Missouri and now certain other states as well.
Well, what I'm hearing you say is that right now, if you go by the state law, forget the federal mandate, but you go by the state law, in Missouri right now, it is against the law for a woman to have an abortion. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. We exempted abortion in the law.
Okay.
Because what we said in the law was that that it was subject to Supreme Court decisions. So if
okay, that makes
so while
sense.
The Supreme Court has Roe versus Wade declaring that abortion's legal, then that law wouldn't apply to abortion. If the Supreme Court returns that decision back to the states, then that law would make abortion illegal.
I understand. Okay, that makes it a lot clearer, and there's a lot of common sense involved in that. Andy, you wrote a book back in 2010. You co-authored a book. It's called Job Creation, How It Really Works, etc., The Capitalist Comeback, The Trump Boom, and the Left's Plan to Stop It. I want to take as much time right now as you would like to discuss this book. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, the first one on job creation was, it came out in 2010 and was an effort to try and get the Obama administration to do some rational things with respect to creating jobs. We recommended that they cut taxes, that they reduce regulations, and that they focus on domestic energy production. Now, we didn't cover trade in that in the book, but we felt those three items would generate the kind of job growth we weren't seeing in the Obama years. You might recall that the Obama administration promised that if we passed their $800 billion stimulus bill, mm-hmm. that unemployment would never go above 8%. Well, it went above 8% the month the bill was passed and stayed there for the next 43 months. So the job creation just wasn't happening coming out of a recession as it should. You should have really dynamic job creation coming out of a recession. So we wrote the book to try and lay out a path so that the administration could understand what it needed to do to get the job market moving. Now, That President Trump obviously took office in 2016 and enacted exactly that plan. He cut taxes, he reduced regulations, he focused on domestic energy production, and he also added in focusing on free and fairer trade agreements so that other countries wouldn't take advantage of American workers and businesses. And that became very, very successful, which is when I wrote the second book, which is called The Capitalist Comeback, The Trump Boom and the Left's Plot to Stop It. And I went through the history of the progressive movement, a lot of things that people aren't getting in high school and college anymore. In fact, the comment I get from people who've read the book, the most common comment is, you know, this book should be mandatory reading in high school or in college classes because, you know, you're giving them a lot of the history that they don't get. And I tried to tie the economics to the history and make it very readable, but basically said, and this came out in early 2018, so a little more than a year after Trump took office, but was written obviously in the year before that, as soon as he took office. And I said, look, the policies President Trump is implementing are going to have a tremendous impact on the economy. We're going to have incredible job growth, incredible job creation, and here's why. And went through the impact of the unions, the impact of our education system, the Bernie Sanders group's impact on what could happen in this country, but also the sort of the basis of our American free enterprise system coming out of the monarchies of Europe in the 1700s, in the late 1700s, and how it really had a tremendous impact worldwide in reducing poverty. Poverty's come down tremendously because of American freestyle capitalism, and GDP per capita, in other words, the amount that people earn across the globe, has gone up dramatically because of American-style free market capitalism. So the second book lays all of that out, and I hope people will read it. It's, I think, a good read.
Well, we'll definitely offer another side, Andy. I want to talk about one other thing about yourself, and then we're going to take a commercial break. We're about 2 minutes away from that. But I want to talk about you and your wife simply because I want people to know exactly what type of, from a personality standpoint, what type of guy I'm talking with right now. Now, you guys are very active in charities, both local and national, all around the country, certainly in your area, which I believe you live in Nashville, and you were in Santa Barbara, but also worldwide. You are contributors, for example, to an organization that my wife and I have been contributors to for a long time, called the Mary No Fathers and Brothers, which basically supports a Father Conroy's ministry with AIDS in Africa, specifically in Cambodia. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, Andy.
Yes, sir. Father Kevin's a great guy, and anybody who contributes to the Mary No Fathers, you can specify it be Father for Kevin, Father Kevin Conroy. But he works with AIDS-addicted children in Cambodia. And other impoverished peoples throughout that section of Asia. It's funny. We met. I got the Alumni of the Year award at Cleveland State University. They give it to five people each year, and Father Kevin got it. He was introduced right before I was, which made my speech a difficult one to give because you follow the guy who's helping AIDS-afflicted children in Cambodia. It's a hard act to follow.
Yeah, it is.
But we got to be friends after that speech, and we have been very proud to support him and the Mary No Fathers.
Well, I want to say good for you. Now, I want to get into politics right after the commercial break. The reason I want to do that is because in 2012 and then again in 2016, Andy, you served as a delegate to the Republican National Convention, and you were also the chairman of the Platform Committee, Subcommittee on the Economy for Job Creation and the Debt, etc., etc. Those are items that are incredibly important right now. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be right back with this gentleman. We're going to talk about political issues as they stand in the country today.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continuing on with the good news from KER, talking with Andy Puzder. Andy is a very interesting guy. We spent the first segment of the show talking about his background. I think all of you will have to agree with me that this is a man who has done everything that he is able to do, everything in his power to help humanity in the country. Before I get into some political discussions, Andy, you have a brochure out right now, a pamphlet, I believe it is, that we are advertising on our site. Can you please tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. It's called It's Time to Get America, Let America Work Again. And it relates to science and the political aspects of ending these lockdowns. You know, recently, the World Health Organization's come out and said these lockdowns were a bad idea. They're leading to suicides. They're leading to drug addiction. They're leading to alcohol addiction. We're seeing starvation of children across the globe because of these lockdowns. They're a bad idea. They need to stop. In the United States, you know, the states that have let up on the lockdowns, unemployment's down, people are getting back to work. The states, mostly Democratic states, that have imposed these lockdowns and continue to follow them are seeing double-digit unemployment and a rise in misery and other infirmities that don't really relate directly to COVID, such as, I said, alcoholism, drug addiction, people not getting mammograms, women not getting mammograms, or people not getting other medical attention they need. So we need to put these lockdowns to an end. This will give you the political and medical arguments for doing so, and hopefully people can help their communities and their states and have the arguments to do so.
You know, Andy, the subject of lockdowns right now is really first and foremost in everybody's mind. Let me give you just a little bit of personal background. You know how old I am. Our listeners know how old I am. My wife is going to turn 71 later this week. My wife is also a dialysis patient. She has to undergo dialysis 3 times a week. To stay alive, quite frankly. And for people like us who are in a bit of a high-risk category, I think self-quarantining is a really good idea. Now, the issue here is people who are high-risk need to use common sense. People who are not in high-risk, folks that are substantially younger, for example, than we are, people who don't have the health challenges that we do, they probably should get back to work. From all the study that I have done, Andy, I agree with you 1,000% on that. And I really highly, because of that, because of my personal feelings, my personal situation, I highly recommend that our listeners do get a copy of your missive on this. We are making it available on our website. Please take a look at it. Let's get from there into politics. That we have a very interesting time right now. The Biden campaign, I think, is simply going overboard in terms of their campaign to the United States. I know that the last virtual wasn't even a debate. The last virtual town hall, I did a fact check on it. Most of the things that Joe Biden said were simply not true. And we have gotten so polarized as a society, Andy, right now. I mean, the polarization is just unbelievable to me. I would really encourage our listeners to take a look at the situation. Take a look at what the Democrats are saying. Take a look at what Trump is saying. Look at the results and cast your vote based on factually what's going on in America today. Any comments? Tell us why you think. I believe, Andy, that you are probably a Trump supporter, as I am and as are most of my friends. Let's hear your argument, Andy.
Well, I think if you look at the president's performance, you look at his first year in office, I think he probably had the most successful first term of any president ever. I mean, we've had an incredible economy. We increased median family income last year more than it's ever been increased to its highest level ever. We reduced poverty to the most amount it's ever been reduced, and we reduced it to the lowest level it's ever hit since they were tracking it back in 1959. If you look at you look around the world at foreign policy, I mean, for God's sakes, not only did we put an end to the threat of ISIS, which, you know, had a country the size of Texas there on in the Middle East for a while, we've now ended that threat, and, you know, can you believe I'm saying this? We're close to getting a deal where we'll have peace in the Middle East. He's done incredible things across the globe. I think a lot of people are reluctant to vote for Donald Trump because even though they know that he's done a great job, they know they're better off. 56% of Americans say they're better off than they were when Obama and Biden were president, and 49% said they agree with President Trump on the issues, or only 46% said they agree with Joe Biden. That's a Gallup poll, a recent Gallup poll. But I think a lot of people are saying, you know, he's just not a good person. I mean, he's not a good guy. He gets portrayed in the press as being a bad guy,
right,
as somebody that maybe you wouldn't want as president. I know the president. The president is a good guy. You know, it is okay to vote for Donald Trump. I mean, he's the kind of guy who would send his plane across the country to pick up sick kids, who paid off the mortgage of a couple that stopped to help him repair his car, and who's been just adamant about bringing home Americans that are held prisoner across the globe. Everybody's got a story about this guy. You know, mine is, the last time I was in the Oval Office, I said, you know, my mom wants you to know, Mr. President, she's 98, and she prays for you every morning. And he immediately said, what's her name? I said, Winnie. He grabbed a hat. He wrote a very nice note to her on the brim of the hat, ended it with love, Donald, and when I gave it to her, she cried. Maybe the best example is, look at his kids. You know, it's not easy always for rich people to have good kids. This guy, there's not a ne'er-do-well in the bunch. There's no alcoholics. There's no drug addicts. His boys run the family business. His daughter and her husband are his top advisors. His other daughter just graduated from law school. You can fake a lot of things in life. You can't fake good kids. I think all moms know that. This is a good, decent human being. If you don't believe me, watch when he's told about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. You won't get the interpretation from the media, you know, what he said or what they think he said or what they claim he meant. You'll just hear him when he gets the news. He's obviously touched, and you hear the reaction of a decent and honorable man to the death of a political foe who wasn't very nice to him, and you get it without the media's interpretation of who he is and what he is. And I think that alone should be enough to let you know what kind of a man he is. And he's a good man, and nobody should feel bad about voting for him. You should be proud to vote for him.
Well, I am, and that's for sure. I have voted for Donald Trump. Let me say this. I happen to be very familiar with the news clip that came out when President Trump was informed of Ginsburg's death. I know they had some philosophical differences, but I agree with you 1,000% about his reaction. It was a reaction of caring, etc., etc., and that was part of the reason that I decided personally that he was really a good guy. Andy, we've only got about 70 seconds here. Let me give you an opinion. I think that the big money in the world, and I want to say that is not necessarily the entire Democratic Party, but the big money in the world is going to be exactly the reason, selfish reasons, that he may lose this election. Do you agree with my statement? Notice I said he may lose. We've got about 10 seconds left here, sir.
I do agree with that. They benefit from this globalist economy. They benefit where American workers don't. And the president's going to watch out for American workers and American small businesses, not the globalists.
Andrew Puzzer, thank you so much for your time, sir. We'll get you back on the show.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in back to KER Politics. It's actually not called KER Politics anymore. It is now called The Good News from KER. There is a lot of absolutely positive, wonderful things happening right now in our society. That's assuming you don't just look at the negative side of it. And Dr. Birnbaum is chatting right now with a gentleman by the name of Bernard Wright. He is a president of an organization called Wave Welcome. This is another example of how Mr. Wright is making America a better place throughout the minority community. Frieda, you got it, babe.
Thank you so much, Al. It's always a pleasure. First of all, happy birthday. October 18th was your birthday, I see. So another day, another year older, another year better, for sure, Bernard.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And the first thing I just want to address is that you have had the amazing honor of working at a senior level for a presidential campaign and achieved the C-level multiple times. Would you tell us about that, please?
Sure. So for a long time, I felt like it was luck. But the reality is that there were certain things that happened in my life that made that possible. So number one was the fact that my mother always focused on education and knowing as much as I could possibly know. The second was that my father showed me the importance of working hard and making sure that you always prepare for whatever task you were in. So that was always something that I took with me and been very flexible. I try to make sure that I have a strong network and that people think highly of me. So when those opportunities presented themselves, I was prepared to move forward and be successful in each one of those opportunities. So that really is it at a high level. Working hard and just making sure I was prepared to be successful for each one of those positions.
Okay. Well, that is just fantastic that you're somebody who can really make that difference. And I see that you're passionate about making sure as many young people as possible see you as someone who has walked in their shoes. So why is that? What is that passion from? What shoes have you walked in that they can really relate to?
I appreciate that question. So for me, in a lot of positions that I've held, I've been the only person, the only black male who's at that level. And for a long time, I wondered why that was the case. And, you know, it's not as simple as racism, because in most cases, that's simply not the reason. A lot of it is because we don't know those opportunities exist. We don't know how to get into those opportunities. We just don't have access to the networks that make those positions possible. So a lot of times at the C level, those positions just are not advertised. So what I'm trying to make sure happens with young people now is that they know what it takes in order to operate at the C level, whether it's CIO or CFO or chief operating officer or any other position at a senior level. And a lot of that means that it's not just technical skills. It's not just knowing how to code or be a project manager. There's a lot of soft skills. There's a lot of networking. There's a lot of presentation. So that's a lot of what I focus on with young people, so that they are able to move into those positions and be successful. But also I'm making sure that I introduce them to people who make decisions about who to hire for those positions.
So that's a goal that as a mentor is something that extremely is important to help people to know what to do. They just don't know what to do. You don't get that in school. You get arithmetic, math, science, but you don't really get the relatability of the world and how to progress and succeed after that. You know, your personal goal while continuing to advance your career is to be recognized as a thought leader who bridges public and private sectors. What are your goals right now? Where is it that you would like to go?
Well, what I would like to see, number one, is that people are considered for positions not based on their networks, but that they're based on what a person can do and bring to an organization. So I would like to see more diversity across the board. That is a conversation that's happening right now. And diversity is not just racial, it's not just gender, it's a number of different things. It's based on age, sexual orientation, religion, any number of factors. But when that happens, you get better thoughts, you get better outcomes, and people are more profitable. So what I'd like to see happen is that across the board, people that can bring things to the table, whether they look like us or whether they think differently, that they get those opportunities. So that's a lot of what I'm focused on now. And if I'm able to accomplish that, then I'd consider myself to be successful. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I wanted to say something.
Yeah, I want to say here, Verna, is I want to say that people like you are the reason that Dr. Birnbaum and I are working so diligently to make this thing work. Diversity is going to do nothing in our country other than strengthen it. Racial inequality is a terrible thing. Frida, I'm going to let you take over. I'm going to turn off my mic.
Okay, you know, it's where you start, Bernard, you have said, and I'm quoting you, where you start does not have to be where you finish. I mean, how profound is that? We can all be free of all prejudices and all obstacles that restrict us when we just go ahead and fly, like you suggest, in our lives to do whatever it is we feel we want to do. And we hope with this, with your kind of mentorship, to help our foundation as well, because we're trying to help underprivileged communities with social services, with funding for career counseling, and listening to mentors like Vernon Wright, who can make more of a difference than anything in their class and anything in their situation where they're really stuck. Because to have the right person to talk to, that's priceless. We don't get that, especially underprivileged communities. They don't have the networking that other communities may have for one another. They don't have the time to have the resources and the people to spend time for them, because they're also struggling. So it's a chain of events that keep going and going. So we are running short. We have about 2 minutes to go. I can't read that, Al. I'm sorry. I can't read that from over here. But you can speak up if you want to tell me something. But, you know, you said that it's imperative that you find ways to be creative and to work with younger people. What kind of ways have you found to be creative?
Well, it's not just, like I said before, it's not just focusing on technology. It really is on focusing on making sure that people are well-rounded, that they're flexible, that they're prepared for opportunities. So I don't just focus on the obvious things. I also make sure that I work with them in track. I make sure that we hang out in social settings so that it demystifies what it means to be an executive. So people are learning even when they don't realize they're learning. So I've done that with internship programs. I've done that in just interactions with young people. And the main reason I do that is because when I was growing up, I really didn't have access to professional Black men. So I didn't even know that that was possible. So I'm trying to be creative and making sure that I make myself available to young people who are trying to emulate the success I've had in my career.
That's so perfect. Thank you. And I'm going to end with a quote that you had said that's extremely profound, and that's why I'm having you and Al is having you on our show. And you said, none of us is perfect, and it is that imperfection within that provides us with the motivation that we need to push forward in our careers and our personal lives. Pushing forward, that's what we do, that's what I do. Can ask Al. I keep pushing forward. Al keeps pushing forward for many, many years. And you are somebody that we are part of now forever, whether you like it or not, because you're the epitome of what it means to be pushing forward. Thank you so much for being on our show. It was a great,
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Thank you, Al. Thank you, Al. Thank you, Bernard. And we're going to have you back on again to hear about all your...
Hey, welcome in. Time to wrap up KER Politics. I have a very interesting woman on the line right now. She's an op-ed writer, and she is also a published author. Her name is Cheryl Chumley. Cheryl has just written a book called Socialists Don't Sleep, America Needs Christians to Get Louder. I think this is a very appropriate topic, Cheryl, particularly given the fact that I think most of us watched the debate last night. And everything that you're talking about is categorically denied by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Now, I happen to agree with you. Tell us a little bit about your book and the rationale behind what you're saying.
Well, Socialists Don't Sleep is basically a tool to give readers a deeper understanding of the sneaky way socialism has already seeped into American society and culture and politics, in hopes that no matter who wins in November and no matter who wins in elections in the future, that Americans will be conditioned to see the socialism before it takes root and grows and spreads. So I actually conceived of this book almost two decades ago when President George Bush was president, when George Bush was president, and he brought forward in cahoots with Democrats a piece of legislation called the American Dream Down Payment Act. And I know probably your listeners don't remember that, but what
I'll
it was
they,
was
I'll bet they do.
It was just for, in case some don't, it was just a piece of legislation that took tax dollars to give to minorities to encourage them to buy homes, with the justification that more minority home ownership was good for all of America. And I remember thinking at the time when Bush signed that into law, my thoughts were, how is that not socialism? And so from there, I conceived the actual book. Right at the time, because actually my husband convinced me at the time that socialism, it wasn't being openly discussed, the timing wasn't right. But look at us now. Now we openly embrace socialism. We actually have card-carrying members of Congress, socialists, serving the American people, taking an oath to the Constitution. So in my, based on identifying this, before we get to the point where it's open socialist serving.
No, let me ask you this. I'm sorry, I lost you just for a minute, Cheryl.
Oh, it's just basically about helping readers understand and identify the seeds of socialism before we get more open socialist serving in public office.
Mm-hmm. Well, what bothers me a lot right now is I'm under the impression, Cheryl, that it's pretty well embedded, and I talk about this a lot, not only with colleagues, but also on the air, and I think there is a very, very well-funded, and perhaps in their own mind, a well-meaning organization run by a guy named George Soros and his son, Alexander Soros. I think they are firmly convinced that the way to save the world is through socialism. I mean, just look at the platform of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. That's all you have to do. And it's very, very obvious. What would you suggest that Americans do to counteract this, Cheryl?
Well, I do go into George Soros and a lot of the globalists who are funding the collectivist socialist movement in America. I agree with you about Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, the weak presidential candidate. If he wins in the White House, it'll be far leftist socialists / communists that are pushing policy into America. So my recommendation is found in the second half. Title of my book, Christians Must Rise or America Will Fall. And I just think, given that America was built on a foundation of Judeo-Christian principles, with the core asset being our individual rights come from God, not government, mm-hmm. we have strayed from that. And we've largely strayed from that because Christians, the Christian community in America, have been too silent in recent years. We've been swept up into the secular pursuits, the more money, the bigger homes, the more cars, the larger TVs, the 401ks. And so now we're reaping what we've sown. We have turned the corner and become a secular nation. And it's no coincidence that the youth in America embracing socialism, because those two things go hand in hand. Atheism and communism are go hand in hand. And so the solution, of course, lies with Christians becoming more vocal, bolder, taking stronger stands publicly to reel back the secularism, and in so doing, bring about a political system that is based more on individual rights with God at the top, not government.
Cheryl, I'd like to ask you one question, and it's a quandary that I'm facing, not personally. I, too, am a Christian, but I have to say that I look at society. Society has gotten to be incredibly secular. It's gotten to be incredibly secular because of the concept of instant gratification. Instant gratification is very appealing to human nature. How can your book and your discussions with other people, your presentations, how do you attack that problem?
Well, you attack educating people and showing how the link between a thriving, growing church community is tied so tightly, inextricably woven, as a matter of fact, to individual freedoms in America. If one falls, the other falls. If the church community in America fails to do its job, and individuals fail to do their Christian duty, then that opens the door to big government coming in and filling the void. So it's crucial to make the link between church and freedom, and make the link between belief in Judeo-Christian principles, belief in biblical guidance, and individual God-given freedoms. Because you do away with one, and what comes is big government. The only way to do it is to talk about it frequently.
We try to talk about it as much as we can on this particular show, Cheryl, and I applaud you for your efforts. I applaud you for this book. Let me just get kind of a personal opinion, and I'm sure that you do share this with your readers, but we got about 2 minutes left. Actually, a little bit more, actually about 2.5 minutes. Cheryl, if you were to paint a picture of what America could very possibly look like within the next 5 years, what would that picture look like?
Socialist. I mean, completely socialist, turning the corner toward communism. Seriously, this is an actual danger. I mean, go ask Venezuela if they ever expected that their country would fall so quickly and so deeply, right? I mean, that was one of the most richest, vibrant nations in the world, filled with resources, and now half the people are living in poverty, starving to death. So America has already seen under the coronavirus how quickly individual freedoms can be yanked away and put into the hands of government bureaucrats, and not even duly elected government bureaucrats. I'm speaking of like health officials, health bureaucrats. They're not accountable to the people. And so you have these politicians who are only too willing to grab power when they can, that they don't rightly own, and citizens nowadays are not fighting. Look at how many citizens just throw face masks on their face because of executive orders and don't question that those executive orders aren't actually laws. These are signs of a degraded nation. These are signs of a nation that is oh too willing to obey government instead of questioning and being thinking citizens like founders intended us to be.
You know, I got to tell you, Cheryl, I agree with you 1,000%. I don't think there's any question about that. That came out front and center, I have to say, in my opinion, in yesterday's debate. You've got the Biden-Harris team basically pushing on government mandates to regulate health issues. You have common sense is totally taken out of the question. It's all about you have to do what the government tells you to do. Scares the daylights out of me. There's no question whatsoever about that. Listeners are aware of the fact that I'm a child of Russian immigrants. They fled Russia in 2017, and I got to tell you, Cheryl, the stories that I lived with when I was growing up because of the flight that my parents took were absolutely appalling. Cheryl, I'll put a link on the site for your book. Thank you so much.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.